Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Looks like we've got a great, good-looking group of people here tonight, so thank you for that. My name is Lydia Khalil. I'm a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute, and I'm going to be the moderator of today's panel. And we have a truly excellent and expert panel here tonight, so I want to keep my introductory remarks as brief as possible so we can really get into the meat of what we're here to talk about. So tonight we're going to try to break down some of the phenomenon of right-wing extremism and right-wing violence. We convene this panel because what we once thought were separate domestic issues and groups are in fact more international in scope. And as Michelle corrected me earlier, perhaps not so much global, but at least transnational. So we want to discuss some of those dynamics. And obviously the Christchurch attack has put this international and transnational nature of right-wing extremism and violence into very, very stark relief. I want to quote another of my fellow Lowy fellows, Kelsey Munro, who actually wrote an op-ed today on this issue and on the role that technology companies have in the Christchurch attack and this issue of right-wing extremism and violence. These technology companies that host content, that enable communication, and that break down barriers, and they've created this online ecosystem for right-wing extremist actors. Now, prior to social media and digital technology platforms, it was much more difficult to identify fellow travelers, very much more difficult to meet in person, to discuss, and to plan. And prior to the advent of social media and internet-enabled communications, right-wing extremist ideas and views were much more in the shadows. They were certainly there, but now they're much more in the mainstream, and technology platforms have certainly acted as enablers to this. Now, New Zealand isn't a country that's necessarily known or associated with right-wing extremism, but the New Zealand attacker was a man who traveled the globe, but he lived on the internet. And on the internet, he became very deeply entrenched in the global extreme right. He was influenced and referenced a whole host of right-wing extremist actors like Anders Breivik, Dylan Roof, Darren Osborne, among others. And from the clothing he wore to the weapons that he used referenced so many international influences. When he was live streaming, for example, he put out played a song by Radovan Kredzic, who's a Bosnian Serb who was responsible for the death of thousands of Bosnian Muslims during the Balkan Wars. So we've treated right-wing extremism as a domestic issue primarily prior to the Christchurch attack, probably because of the nature of right-wing extremism itself, which is focused on national identity. But have we focused on these domestic dynamics to the detriment of appreciating perhaps the transnational and international aspects of right-wing extremism? Now, to discuss all of this, we have with us here Dr. Christy Campion from Charles Stewart University. She is a lecturer in the Terrorism Studies Department, focusing on the history of terrorism and right-wing extremism. She most recently wrote a very excellent piece on perspectives in terrorism on right-wing extremism in Australia. I encourage you to take a look at that. We also have Dr. David Smith, who is jointly appointed between the U.S. Studies Center and the School of Social and Political Science here in the University of Sydney. And his research examines political relations between states and minorities with a focus on religion in the United States. And he's published and commented widely, including in the New York Times, on issue of religion, race, populism, and right-wing extremism. And last but not least, we have Dr. Michelle Grossman, who is a research chair in diversity and community resilience in the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalization. And she leads the AVERT Network, which is Addressing Violent Extremism and Radicalization to Terrorism Research Network. It's always a mouthful. And she works with a wide variety of government agencies in Australia and around the world. And recently in 2019, she became the director of, wait for it, another mouthful, the new Collaborative Center of Excellence for Resilient Communities and Inclusive Societies. And it's an international consortium of research on strengthening community resilience and reducing social harms. So please join me in welcoming our panelists here tonight. So Christy, I'm gonna throw the first question to you, and it's a two-part question. Right-wing extremism is different to holding political views that are right of center or having cultural views that are right of center. Can you define for us what we mean when we talk about right-wing extremism? You know, what are the beliefs and attitudes that underpin right-wing extremist groups? And what do you consider the nature of the transnational or global right-wing movement, even if you could even define it as that?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So one of the things that I noticed in the aftermath of Christchurch was that the public discourse about exactly what right-wing extremism was, how we define it, what it's constituted with, was pretty limited. So what I saw and what some of you may have seen as well was what I see as a fairly common conflation of right-wing extremism purely with racism or purely with hate-orientated groups. Now, that's problematic because when we're talking about right-wing extremism, we're actually talking about three primary defining tenets. One of them is being authoritarian. So these groups tend to be quite favorably disposed towards the restriction of liberties, towards elevating the collective over the individual, concepts of a strong state, strong leaders, that sort of thing. Secondly, they tend to be profoundly undemocratic. Now, this goes with concepts and beliefs that democracy is flawed as a method of government, but it also flows on through to ideas around the concepts that democracy champions, they oppose. So, for example, equality before the law, multiculturalism, inclusivity, the sort of ideas that democracies champion, they oppose. So they're quite undemocratic. And finally, the last one, which I think is where it sort of has a lot of interchange with racism, is exclusionary nationalism. So they tend to have quite categorical thinking about what constitutes the citizen, how the citizen should look, how the citizen should act. That tends to feed into and include ethnicity, sexuality, that sort of thing. So they're quite prescriptive in who they pretend to champion. Now, where does racism fit in? So we tend to see it as racism and hate crime we see as almost a close cousin, as it were, with right-wing extremism. So it does feed into some movements, but not all of these movements. Now, the problem with that is when you have a public discourse that's focused on racism, is that it means people actually don't know what right-wing extremism looks like when they're faced with it. So how do you identify a group that's not openly racist, that's not openly vilifying ethnicities? They might believe or have fascist ideologies, but if they don't look racist, how are people going to know, oh, that's what they are? So I think that's a big problem at the moment with how we're talking about right-wing extremism. We're not actually going, okay, what happens when they're not racist or when they're not openly racist? Their ideologies underneath it tend to have racial elements or racialized elements, but they're not always racist in themselves. Now, in regards to what they believe, which I think was the second part of the question, I might have twisted it. Broadly speaking, the extreme right don't always agree on everything. Unfortunately, areas of disparity are significant. So when we talk about what they believe, okay, well, you've got certain right-wing extremists that are pagan revivalists. They believe in concepts of the eternal order. You have others who are atheists. You have others who are agnostics. You have others that are Christian identity. In Australia, we see, historically, there's been quite a large number of pagan revivalists. So it's sort of difficult to categorize them as, oh, this is what they believe. This is their single defining tenet. However, one thing I would highlight that is common regardless of their personal belief systems is this concept of peril. So when you're looking at right-wing, Australian-authored right-wing manifestos, what you're actually looking at is narratives of peril. So you have groups of people that, for any reason, believe that their way of life, the way they construct it, the way that they perceive it, is imperiled by a variety of factors.
Now, that's actually a great segue to something that I wanted, Michelle, if you could address this idea of peril, Christy, that you were talking about. But Michelle, you've studied extremism in all its forms for a long time, and this idea of peril or crisis or threat seems to be or something to address urgently, either through force or violence, seems to be underpinning a lot of this stuff. Can you talk to us a little bit more about this idea that Christy introduced?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the throw, Christy. Look, I think one of the things that we can get a bit blindsided by is that when we are diving deeply into what you might call the ideological detail of what different varieties of political or religious or even gender-based extremism might look like, we get the impression that these are movements and ideological frameworks that are almost implacably opposed to each other. And that can sometimes obscure some of the common elements. So I would say there are really three common elements that you find across all modes of politically or ideologically inspired extremism, which I would certainly class right-wing extremism as one of those. The first is a narrative around peril or threat. Okay. Now it's very interesting because you can see that in Islamist extremist movements. You certainly see it in right-wing movements. So the idea of peril or threat—you saw it. You could arguably see it back in the United States in relation to sovereign staters, for example. The idea that there is an imminent threat, that if people do not rise up to counter it, that you're simply going to be, you know, sort of trampled to death. But I think that there are some nuances that we want to pay attention to here. There is one narrative within right-wing extremism that is really also about perceptions of loss and grief. Okay, so the idea that people who saw themselves as at the top of a social tree, yeah, in terms of the social order, are now feeling that they've been displaced, that they've been disrespected, that their position is no longer secure. So in an extreme sense, we see the outcome of that in things like the Great Replacement Theory, that people like the Christchurch attacker.
So what would be the Great Replacement Theory?
Okay, so the Great Replacement Theory is the idea that these hordes of others who are not like us are simply going to breed and breed and breed and take over, and that we will become the abject and the denizens. Okay, so it's really about the restructuring of power. So there's certainly that nuance of threat, and that sense of threat is different than the aspirational threats of movements that say, well, we've never had power, right? And that's what we're aiming to. But the second, threat alone is not enough. You also then have to have deeply held narratives and experiences of a grievance, okay? Mm-hmm. So you've got threat, and then you've got grievance, and the final element that you find cutting across all modes of political and ideological extremism is the adoption of being the victim, okay? The status of the victim, and for me, that is really the key. So right-wing extremists say, we are being victimized, right? We are being victimized by Muslims. We are being victimized by feminists. We are being victimized by Jews. We're being victimized by Democrats, right? So Democrats and democracy becomes the threat. And these poor people, you know, who say we're the victims, right? You know, our power, our privilege, our entitlement is being threatened. Now, the experience of victimization and the narrative of victimization becomes then a way of legitimating the rise up to action, okay? So I think when you take perceived threat, deeply held grievance, but the victim part is the part that actually enables and legitimates violent action, and that's how it's justified. So I think those are the three elements that you find across all forms of extremism.
Right. Well, so let's add another element to this. So David, one of the things, in addition to those three factors that seem to be feature prominently in extremist discourse is conspiracy or conspiracy theories.
Yes.
And that's something that you've written about and discussed in the past. Mm. You know, I'm shocked what otherwise well-informed people believe to be true about certain things. Mm. But I've come to learn also it's not necessarily a lack of information, but it's more of a distrust or alienation from power that might drive some of these conspiracy theories. So how does that all factor in when we're talking about conspiracy theories and right-wing extremism?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people believe a lot of conspiracy theories for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of them are fairly harmless. If someone spends their life trying to uncover the truth about JFK, harmless. Even a lot of the 9/11 truthers, I commented in the Herald the other day that 9/11 conspiracy theories have been debunked. Overnight, about 9 emails popped up, you know, generally no text, just links. Like, well, look at this video. I mean, once again, that's pretty harmless. The conspiracy theories that are dangerous are in this kind of racialized context. And the kind of classic conspiracy theory that has been around for so long is about Jewish control of the world. So seeing Jewish agency at the bottom of everything, even when the racial conflict that people are involved in might be white-black, they see Jews as being behind blacks. So that's the sort of classic form of this. What we've seen in the last 20 years or so is that there are conspiracy theories about Islam developing in very, very similar ways as conspiracy theories about Jews. So not only are both of these racialized religions, in a sense that they are religious groups that in people's minds come to take on racial characteristics, a lot of this racialization is based on the idea that they are trying to take control of the world. This is a relatively recent thing around Islam. You see, prior to 9/11, in the 70s, 80s, 60s, there was anti-Islamic sentiment around, but a lot of it was based on these Arabs just got lucky with oil, you know, but they're fundamentally weak and effeminate. After 9/11, you see not just conspiracy theories around terrorism. You see conspiracy theories around they're out to implement Sharia law. And also, coming back to this replacement theory, that was envisioned largely as a conscious conspiracy theory. And one of the really damaging things about that was the amount of mainstream coverage that that got. That conspiracy theory was not something that spread on the internet. That was best-selling books. Arabia by Bat-Yayor, America Alone by Mark Stein, Christopher Caldwell's book, I think it was called Can Europe Be the Same Place with Different People, Melanie Phillips's London Astan. Mainstream columnists writing for mainstream newspapers writing insane conspiracy theories with just ludicrous demographic projections about what was about to happen. One of the effects, I found this very interesting as an Australian at the time living in the US, one of the really interesting effects of this conspiracy theory was to turn the entire continent of Europe into a cautionary tale for people in Australia and the US, right? So for people in Australia and the US to say, look at what Europe has allowed itself to become. It's allowed itself to become overrun by Muslims. And we see with the Christchurch gunman, you know, maybe he actually had a bit of trouble feeling that righteous victimhood in Australia, where he couldn't conceivably imagine himself as being a member of a victimized minority. He went to France and he went to Sweden and he formulated these fantasies about the takeover. France has a very special role in the conspiracy theorist imagination because they've seen it as it's always been this site of conflict between the West and Islam, and this was the place that Muslims wanted to recolonize, and that France has allowed it to happen. So there's always this discourse about weak elites or people who are actively in league with the enemy. So this conspiracy theorizing, I think that this is very directly linked to violence because it is what makes people identify targets. Not just in the Christchurch shooting, in the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh at a synagogue. That was from somebody who came to believe that George Soros and various Jewish interests were promoting caravans of migrants coming up from Central America. It's interesting that these conspiracy theories around the caravan of Central American migrants, the conspiracy theories aren't about the migrants themselves. They're either about control by Jewish groups, controlled by George Soros, or that they're a Trojan horse for Islamic jihadi groups. So there's this very, very sort of close link between anti-Semitic and anti-Islamic conspiracy theories. And I think that these really do generate violence because of the way that they, first of all, because of the way that they allow people to identify targets, and second, because so much of this stuff is actually spouted in the mainstream, including stuff that's very adjacent to it from the President of the United States. And that increases the plausibility of it for many people.
I would just say that link to what David has just been saying, I think that some of this reflects the very profound anxieties that a lot of people have. So it's always about the forces that lie, that you can't see, right? And that lie behind the nation state. And so to some extent, conspiracy theories, you could argue, are actually a way of trying to work out and accommodate globalization, okay, and the fact that nation states are not what they used to be in terms of relationships. So I think that's right. Definitely a part of that.
Yeah. At the bottom of most of these conspiracy theories is the idea that democratic government is just, it's a Potemkin village. It's a sham. There is a permanent government that's beneath all of it. And it doesn't matter how often government changes. You know, be a genuine hardcore right-wing conspiracy theorist, A mainstream conservative party, they're no better than a communist party. You know, it's all controlled by this permanent government that probably has a global basis to it.
And the skin of a lizard.
Yes. Yeah, yes. In some cases, there are literal lizard theories, yes.
Well, with that, let's bring it back a bit more to Australia. So, Christy, I wanted to ask you, because you've been taking a close look at right-wing extremism in the Australian context specifically. Again, Christchurch really brought a lot of this stuff into focus for us. But as you've written before, right-wing extremism in Australia is not new. And it was predated social media and it predated the internet and all of that stuff. So can you talk to us a little bit about how it's manifested here in Australia and what the, if any, transnational connections there have been between Australian movements and elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, one of the things my research has sort of established recently is that right-wing extremism, its sentiment, its movements have actually been in Australia since the 1920s. Now, certain ideas behind it, so ideas like yellow peril and siege mentality, they go back further. But as far as movements go, we can track them to the 1920s. The reason for that is obviously the Bolshevik Revolution. So the first right-wing extremists in Australia, they weren't concerned about Islam, they were concerned about Bolsheviks. So within the context of their time, they had quite a lot of economic distress, they had feelings of insecurity, they had feelings of grievance. They basically started forming paramilitary groups, they started stockpiling weapons, and they started going, okay, how can we get rid of Jack Lang? Because he was their primary target. They considered him a socialist. So you would think that that after World War II and you know the supposed defeat of fascism, that these groups would sort of fade away, but they didn't. And what we actually saw instead was the Australian League of Rights. Now, they were hugely conspiratorial. I wasn't originally going to talk about it, but I'll touch on it. So the primary theory that they championed was the concept of ZOG, the Zionist Occupation Government. So they believed that they were this super state that had, A, engineered World War II, engineered the Holocaust, and that they were controlling the governments of the world through international finance, bonds, that sort of thing, and that by, this is their thoughts by the way, that by playing the victim in the Holocaust, Jews had managed to gain entrance to every nation in the world. That is the idea that they championed. They wrote a book about it, they published it. No one really liked it in Australia. It didn't really go very far, but it did get some traction overseas. Now, they were an international organisation, so chapters in New Zealand and chapters in the United Kingdom. But flowing on from that, when you see these movements rise in Australia, what you tend to see, in addition to that, is international links. So, for example, the next sort of incident was in 1964, where you had the Australian National Socialist Movement. It's a bit of a mouthful. They were noticed to have international links because they started reaching out to right-wing leaders around the world. So they started reaching out to neo-Nazis in the US. They started reaching out to fascists in the UK. One of the people that they were quite close with was Oswald Mosley of the British Union of Fascists. Now, that trend, that sort of interconnectivity, it doesn't change over time. It actually continues. So when you look at the Australian Nationalist Movement in Perth, they were the ones that ran the firebombing campaign. They too were conspiratorial. They expanded theirs. So they believed that the police were in on it, because obviously they had their own interactions with police, but they believed that the police were the puppets of the Jews, effectively. They also went on personal journeys around the world. They went to the USA, they went to the UK, and they went to Europe as well. Now, the reasons for this isn't just because they, you know, got bitten by the travel bug. It's because they're looking for validation. People that agree with their ideas, people that might have influence or some sort of authority, both internationally and domestically. And so when the leader of ANM, Jack Van Tongeren, returned to Australia and he launched his firebombing campaign in Perth, he claimed that not only was he part of an international movement, but that he was leading that movement and that all the other organisations in the world were taking the lead from him. Now, as time went on, obviously, don't want to move into your space at all, but obviously the internet happens. In 1995, we see the establishment of Stormfront, which is still active to this day. It's got a special section for Australia. And that's when you start seeing right-wing extremists engage a bit more online. I'll cut that off. Modern groups also demonstrate the same level of international connectivity. So you only need to go on Gab for about 10 minutes to see that Blair Cottrell is sharing things from all over the world. He's only following significant people in the international right-wing nexus. So this this internationalization, it's not an accident. It's not something that has sort of developed slowly. It's a product of a conscious choice. Now, part of that, I suspect, might go back to concepts in National Socialism itself, which was the intention of, I can't pronounce the word, but the German word is translates roughly to community of fate. So this idea that there is this white pride worldwide movement, that there is this, or that if there isn't, that there should be an international network of white supremacists that are working to regain control over their respective nations, working to free their society, to free the morally pure people, the people that they consider to be one of them from influence from Jews and from communists, from the left wing, all that sort of thing.
So they were seeking these international connections, but were they also getting validation in Australia within the Australian context? Was it a bit of both, or were they seeking the international validation because they lacked it here?
Quite interestingly, some of them had more success internationally than what they had here. So primarily, there was a Melbourne lawyer called Alexander Rudd Mills. Now, you can go and try and find his books in the library and you won't find them. It took me a lot of trouble to get a hold of them because they didn't gain any traction here. So essentially what he argues in a book called The Odinist Religion is that the so-called white race is imperiled by what he believes to be the quote-unquote Jew worship of Christianity, and that the Jews are leading the white race into decay through things like multiculturalism, sexual liberation, that sort of thing. So his ideas did not gain traction in Australia. He tried to start a Church of Odin. It didn't really take off. But that book then went to America, where it was picked up by prominent American right-wing extremists, people who started the Odinist Fellowship, who started talking to the Aryan Nations, and it actually proliferated there. Now, ultimately, they didn't adopt everything that he suggested because they believed he was too Masonic. But he had quite a significant impact in shaping racial concepts of racialism and racial purity in the United States. And that had no impact here. It wasn't popular.
Interesting. Okay, so that's the Australian influence over to America. But David, if I take it to you and go across the Pacific to the American influence to Australia and around the world, the violent far right and white supremacist movement and militia movement in the US, again, has been going on for quite a long time, as you've researched and written about. But there is this idea going around that the election of our current president, Donald Trump, has given them a particular boost, a special boost.
Yes.
Is that a correct assumption?
Yes.
Is there an argument to support this? And if so, what are the global implications if, you know, the leader of the free world supposedly is a champion of white supremacists?
Yeah. It is a very significant event. So there are a few levels to this. One is having the most powerful person in the world talking about an invasion of the United States and talking about the need to use violence against an invasion. You don't usually hear a world leader talking like that. And so for a lot of people, it's great. Our time has come. And there really was a sense, you could see it when he got elected, for a whole lot of people, the idea, now we can act with impunity, right? Because now we know that all of the forces aren't arrayed on the other side. We know we at least have, somebody very powerful on our side. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that Trump has created because he's such a focal point, because everyone in the world knows who he is, he's created a new vocabulary, a new sort of raft of symbolism, everything from the red hat to the OK hand symbol, which has just been gleefully adopted as like, yes, now we've got white supremacist symbols that everyone understands, right, and that everybody recognises. So he's actually created a global common vocabulary and symbolism for the far right, even if he doesn't personally identify with it. There are plenty of people on the far right who identify with him, and they identify with the violence in his language. When he says things like he doesn't want migrants from shithole countries, he would like more migrants from Norway. You could read that as innocently as you want, but that is certainly not how white supremacists are reading it. As far as they see it for what it is, they think that his relationship with Putin is fantastic because Putin is someone they see as someone who's set himself up as an explicitly anti-liberal figure who is fighting the decadence of the West. So they see this sort of white internationalism emerging with Donald Trump. So, yes, he has definitely been very, very important.
Yeah, well, and that's interesting. Putin doesn't often come up as an example, but he certainly is one as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what Christy was talking about in terms of the authoritarianism. Okay, so they love Putin's authoritarianism. They love the fact that, yeah, he stands up to the decadent West, that he has sort of, he's forging this block that is the East that has a really strong sense of its own identity, that is grounded in Christianity, that is grounded in whiteness. They love the fact that he is openly homophobic, right? So that he's driving all of the homosexuality and effeminacy out of the country. I mean, it should surprise no one that there's a strongly sort of masculinist element to this as well. This is something else that they see in Trump. They believe that that's someone who he doesn't make any concessions to political correctness. He doesn't make any concessions to feminism.
I don't know if Trump would look as good riding shirtless on a horse, though.
No.
Easy, so.
No.
Yeah.
Thank you for putting that thought in my head. Lee, I don't know if I'll sleep tonight now.
As you can see on the number of pages on my lap, I have about a million questions for our panelists. I'm going to indulge in one more before I open it up to the audience, and that's to you, Michelle. And I just want to end my questions, reluctantly, talking about online culture and the responsibility of technology platforms. And do they inherently lend themselves to extremism and thought and activity, or is that putting too much of a onus on that? Have they helped normalize extremism, or is it really about us and this is another venue for us to behave badly?
Look, it's a good question, and it's one that there's a lot of debate and airplay around this. Digital environments, the internet, social media, they really are just another communication modality, okay? So, and in my previous research life, I focused very heavily on communication and culture-based research. So I think saying the internet is responsible for extremism is like saying the telephone is responsible for extremism, you know, or the shift from manuscript culture to, you know, the printing press. Actually, the shift from handwritten manuscripts to the automated printing press is, you know, part of the Industrial Revolution, arguably had the same impact, I think, in terms of the evidence of the shifts that new technologies can make, right? I mean, it absolutely revolutionized the nature of political contestation and power dynamics in an earlier period of history that we see the digital environment doing today. But that is not the same as saying that there is a causal relationship. So I think the digital world is enabling, you know, the affordances of digital technologies are enabling certain things, okay? They do enable much speedier communication. They enable the kinds of solidarity, communitarian sort of impulses, to be strengthened in these international and transnational networks. But you have to ask yourself, if we took away the digital environment today, if we took away the internet, and if we took away social media, would extremism exist? Well, the answer is bloody oath, right? Bloody oath it would, as it has, right? You know, throughout history. So I think that when we start to look at what the technologies do, we need to understand their dynamics, we need to understand their capacities and potentialities, and we need to think about how we want to mobilize the use of those to try to reduce social harms and expand social goods. But I would liken it most at the in the current moment around the question of how extremists use the internet. It's the frontier. Okay. It's still a frontier environment. You've got these big tech companies who pretty much have been able to do what they want, as they want. Very neoliberal framing, right? The idea is that the digital economic marketplace, but also the digital social and cultural marketplace, we're going to self-regulate amidst all this plurality and diversity and eventually sort of find their level. Right? Now, that obviously hasn't happened quite in the way that they had perhaps envisaged. But whereas we see a lot of regulation and acceptance of regulation in other areas of social life and social communication, the frontier mentality around the digital world, I think, has really persisted. That is now starting to change, but it's starting to change precisely. We haven't, it's not just right-wing extremism. Look at how Islamic State and a range of other movements have used the internet. Look at what Brenton Tarrant did in Christchurch in terms of live streaming. These are not the only atrocities, by the way, that happen on the internet, and there are things that happen outside the world of extremist ideology that are just as disturbing. Mm. But I think it's precisely the way in which extremists across a whole variety of platforms have pushed the boundaries. They've really pushed at that frontier that has now started to get people saying, look, we really need to think about regulation. But even so, regulating the environment, it will never eliminate some of these issues, but it will no longer be, I think, the frontier, the wild frontier that it has been to date.
Yeah, seems like we get that with a lot of new kind of waves and industries going forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. Well, with that, I'm mindful of opening it up to the audience for questions because I think that there might be a lot. What I might do is take maybe three questions in a row and then have the panelists address what they'd like. So I think there are a few up front here.
Hi. You spoke about how when oppressed groups express a sense of victimhood, that's not extremism. So there seems to be some sort of integral quality of imaginariness, I guess, to the narratives of victimhood of right-wing extremists, and then couple that with the post hoc pathologizing of extremist terrorists after they perpetrate attack. I was just wondering, just from your expertise, where on the scale of from delusional to perfectly rational would you situate right-wing extremist thinkers?
You spoke about sort of the history of right-wing extremism, and it seems to kind of ebb and flow in and out of prominence. I was just wondering, Trump wasn't elected in a vacuum, and there's been a lot of election of, you know, sort of the more right-wing leadership across the world. Are there other factors like social, economic factors that might help trigger these kind of ideologies to sort of move to the forefront or popularity?
You talked about transnational connections. I'm thinking about an international perspective on far-right extremism because, of course, different national contexts will look very different. Or do they look similar? I'm thinking about far-right extremism in India around Hindu nationalism. I'm thinking about far-right extremism in Japan. I'm thinking about other kind of national contexts. What can we learn about far-right extremism as a phenomenon that takes into account that truly international perspective on the phenomenon?
Yeah, we were just having exactly that discussion before we came out. So all really great questions. I'll open to anyone who'd like to address it first.
I'll have a go at all, trying to say something quickly about all three. On the question of the extent to which right-wing extremism is a delusional or a rational phenomenon, I think I would want to broaden that out to all forms of ideologically motivated extremism. I'm not a big fan of rational actor theory, but I also don't think that it is helpful to think of these as just pure or clinical pathologies, okay? The question that we have to ask ourselves is, and it's a very important question, to what extent do we live, what is this telling us about how we manage the politics of diversity of views, all the things that make a democracy what it is, which actually says, you know, you can be as extremist as you like in your head, you can think what you like as long as it doesn't hurt other people. Is there a disconnection from reality? Who's to say? We live in a world where interpretation of our current social and political environment, that's what a democracy is. It allows for those interpretations. It allows for some diversity in perspective and viewpoint. So I think it's easy, if you accuse people of being delusional, to sort of slip into a position where you simply say there's only one way to see the world, and if you don't see the world the way I see it, then you're on the outer. That becomes the same kind of exclusivism that we're actually, you know, sort of struggling against. So it's a tough question, but I think the truth probably lies somewhere in between. Just very quickly I'll leave the Trump question. I have a lot to say about that, but I'll leave that to others. The question that Malcolm raised about the international dimensions. Look, I think that when we talk about right-wing extremism, that we are talking through a very Western frame of reference, okay? And the boundary lines between what's conservative, what versus what's right-wing. Terrorism is a global threat. But I think it's drawing too long a bow to say that there is such a thing as global right-wing extremism. There are big pockets of the globe that actually are not experiencing this problem in this particular way. There are, however, lots of authoritarian governments and lots of authoritarian movements and counterculture movements, that have for centuries weighed in against, certain forms of permissiveness or liberalism or, tolerance of others. These are effectively very bounded by local conditions. And to the extent that they make connections internationally, I think it's often for more strategic or tactical purposes than it is out of any deep wellspring of really internationally shared value. So I think we need to distinguish between what I'd call the tactical level of interconnectivity that Christy was referring to before versus that more profound level of the extent to which these values are really shared internationally or whether they're more locally shaped. Mm.
David, do you want to address the issue about Trump and how he wasn't elected in a vacuum and what other grievances might be at play?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a whole range of backlash grievances that were at play in the election of Trump. And it's no surprise that Trump comes after Barack Obama. Okay. So for a lot of people, the Obama presidency was just too much. During the Obama presidency, so Obama came into the presidency with this fantasy of a post-racial America. His presidency was going to heal you know, heal the racial wounds in the country and then we can all pretend that all that never happened, etc. Instead, what happened was that police killings of black men started to become more high profile. African Americans saw that having a black president didn't help people at the bottom end of the scale. African Americans started to become a lot more assertive. You had the Black Lives Matter. For people who are familiar with revolutionary theory, this is classic J-curve stuff, right? So the unrest doesn't begin when people are at their lowest point. It's when they've actually had some kind of taste of opportunity that then goes unfulfilled. And for a lot of African Americans, that's what the Obama presidency was. Now, on the other side of the ledger, for a lot of white Americans, that was like, well, we give them their own president and look what they do. You know, it just makes everything worse. And so this idea takes hold that that Obama had promoted racial divisiveness, which he hadn't at all. He spent his first term trying to avoid mentioning race at all. It became unavoidable in his second term. So you've got that sort of backlash dynamic, the idea things have gone too far. Then couple that with the first female candidate, someone who had become a hate figure for the right during the Bill Clinton administration. And, you know, you couple that with Trump being the first politician in generations to actually say what a lot of people were thinking about free trade. You know, I lived in Michigan for 7 years and I never met anyone in Michigan who thought that NAFTA was a great idea. Trump actually came out and said that. So that sort of added to his sense of credibility among people, like, wow, this guy actually knows what's going on and will tell it like it is. So I think backlash dynamics are really important in all of this. A lot of this happens in response to the perception that gains for minority groups or for women have gone too far. And that you know, there needs to be some kind of pushback. Now, literally any gain by a minority group or women will cause backlash in this sense. And I think it's always a mistake to then turn around and say, well, things are just moving too fast. You know, it's never that they're moving too fast. It's that some people don't want to deal with it.
If I could just say very quickly there, I think one of the central dynamic that you've touched on there is that the perception amongst a range of extremist groups of anywhere on the ideological spectrum is that somebody else's gain is always your own loss, okay? It's the ledger of gain and loss, gain and loss, gain and loss. And that's one of the key drivers here, so that it's not possible for other people to get more of what you've already got without you claiming to be and feeling totally deprived, and as if you have to seize that back. And the threat is the idea that you've had something taken away. I mean, the idea of the infant comes to mind here. You know, that something's been seized from you, right? And you've got to get it back. And that, I think, goes a long way. Just, but your question was also about, is Trump not alone, right? Is Trump not alone? And I think that a lot of what David has said actually applies right across. You could easily argue that a lot of the rise or the resurgence of right-wing extremism, which never really died away in Europe, but is actually backlash about some of the perceived grievances in relation to the European Union, you know, to Schengen, to the changes in the economy and particularly mobility, you know, between countries. It's all playing in there. And you're absolutely right. He's not alone.
We'll open it up to additional questions. Be quick, because I have a lot of questions.
You've been asked whether right-wing extremism is the same as in other countries. How about other times? To what extent are the right-wing extremists of today kind of like the establishment of 80 years ago? Or, for that matter, are the anti-Islamic extremists now a lot like, in some way, analogous to the Wahhabi extremists today?
Thanks very much for your presentation tonight. I was just wondering what you all think is the best way for the public and private sector to work together. I understand it's a lot of sort of, obviously have to be a lot of compromise between them, but the best way for them to try and stop the spread of hate online. Thank you.
Well, since we're wrapping up, I can't help but add one more question to the mix, so make it an even three for those. And that, and it follows from the previous ones too. And I wonder how much of this issue with right-wing extremism is actually a class issue, or what role does class play? in all of this? Because, you know, we talk a lot about the appeal of like populism or right-wing views among the working class, and there's been this like fetishization of the white working class in America. But, you know, there have been polls that show that people who voted for Obama also voted for Trump. Or Trump got over the line because well-educated upper-middle-class whites in America voted for him. So, yeah, I think class might be an interesting also dynamic to explore in these. So comparing movements of the past, how the public and private sector can work together, and this issue of class. So, Christy, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I just want to speak to the first question mostly. One of the big things that happened around the 70s in Australia was the deliberate choice for groups that openly identified as being National Socialist to actually change their branding, because what they were finding was that Australians didn't really love swastikas. Wild idea. And so what they did was they started putting in a Cobra on their images. They started quoting Henry Lawson. They started trying to localize the National Socialist aesthetic to the Australian domestic environment. And that did actually work. And obviously we see today, you know, look, most of you would probably be familiar with Antipodean Resistance's image, which is an Akubra, you know, and they talk about, you know, great Australian writers and whatnot. And so, you know, so there was a deliberate choice to rebrand away from the National Socialist dynamic. However, one thing I would make note of is that the period of time you're referring to is quite significant in the narrative for certain groups at the moment. So, for example, there was an interview with a member of the Lad Society. And in that interview, he articulates what he believes to be a nation in chaos. And he refers to it as a Weimar. And that's significant because when we, you know, as historians, when we look at the Weimar, what we're talking about is a time of economic distress. We're talking about hyperinflation. We're talking about Germany's struggles following some of the restrictions imposed on it after World War I. One of those restrictions was the limitation of the size of its army, which meant a number of disaffected and unemployed soldiers formed ultra-nationalistic paramilitaries that went and engaged in quite a lot of violence. And that eventually led to Hitler, which then led to the Third Reich. So when the Lad Society talk about this, they say, well, society right now is in a golden cage. The masses have been appeased with you know, a limited amount of affluence. And so they don't realize that their entire social order is crumbling around them. So they draw parallels between the Weimar and right now. And so what that means for us is, okay, what happens next? Do we have to keep an eye out for the formation of the Free Corps? You know, that sort of thing. So one of the things about these movements, one of the things that makes them extreme is the way that they glorify and venerate the past, and they want to bring that past or elements of it to the present day. And so that's something that we have to be quite sensitive to when we look at the narratives that these people are espousing. Now, going to your question about how do we counter that, I can't really talk about CT much because I'm a historian and I deal with books. But one thing that I would say is we need an effective counter narrative. So one of the things that I've noticed is when we talk about right-wing extremists, like, oh, they're just Nazis, as though that should fundamentally delegitimize them. No one's going, okay, but what is it about fascism that's incompatible with Australian democracy? What is it about what they're saying that's incompatible with Australian way of life? How would their end state come about? You know, and it's asking those questions which exposes, oh, actually, these groups are really extreme. You know, these groups think that violence and struggle is the only way to weed out the weak so that the strong can rise again, you know? You probably have stuff to say on that. Yeah.
Okay. Just nothing to add on the historical front, because that's you're very much more an expert there than I am. But on the question of what can public-private sector relationships look like in this space, you're going to get a very socialist answer from me on this front. I think the public push and the public will is what's going to lead the private sector on this, okay? I don't really see that much of a leadership role for the private sector, and I have said this, I've said this publicly on a number of occasions. I think that when we are talking about issues of who and where we want to be, the private sector is private for a reason, and it is fundamentally focused, on securing its place in a market economy. Great, you know, go for it. But that, to me, is not really the issue that we're looking at here. And I think it is a question of the responsibility that each and every one of us needs to take as public citizens, okay, as citizens who share a public and a polity with each other about where it is that we want to draw the line and where we want to set the boundaries for the private sector, okay, in terms of what we say is tolerable and acceptable. Now, we've seen exactly that happen in the case of Christchurch, okay, where not only Jacinda Ardern, but a number of other people said, enough is enough. And that came after years. We have been talking to the private sector and talking to the tech companies. Governments have been talking to them for years and years and years, saying, you've got to do something, you've got to do something, you've got to do something. And the answer was no, 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 no. And well, now the answer is okay. You know, let's talk about it. But that shows you the direction in which the push is moving. So I'm very happy for the private sector to take its cues, if you like, from the public conversation and the public will on this. Quickly on the question of class, let us. It may very well be an issue in right wing extremism in certain contexts, in certain countries, in certain places. But let's be cautious. The assumption for a long time in relation to Islamist and jihadist violent extremism was that it is, you know, poor people, downtrodden people, ill-educated people. Now, there's an awful lot of evidence and an awful lot of an empirical base to say that that is not necessarily the case. And in fact, if you look at the Easter attacks in Sri Lanka and the leadership of that, all well-educated, all from, you know, in Sri Lankan terms, pretty affluent backgrounds. Okay, so I think we need to ask the question about the role that class plays, but I don't think we can make any easier complacent assumptions about that. I think we actually need to say, what is the evidence base and where is it, how is class playing out? Not is it or isn't it a factor, but how is it a factor in certain contexts, certain places, and certain movements?
Fair enough. David, we'll leave you with the last word.
Yeah, certainly just on the class issue, there's no doubt that right-wing extremists, they love the imagery of the working class, right? They love to see themselves as the salt of the earth, the manual labor it's this almost sort of quasi-left rhetoric about, you know, we've been preyed on by these parasites. That's why they call anti-Semitism the socialism of fools. This is why, in France you have the Yellow Vest movement. Sure, not everyone involved in that's a manual labourer, but they love the sort of imagery of the yellow vest. You've got attempts to replicate that in Australia. So I agree that there actually needs to be a serious look into this, but it always astonishes me actually how cross-class it is. And, you know, for every desperate, unemployed manual worker you've got who picks up the brick out of desperation, you've also got some quite well-educated crackpot intellectual out there, writing manifestos. Just on the final point about the private sector, there was an article by an American investigative journalist called Judd Legum a couple of days ago asking the very sensible question, why is 8chan, right, the website where the Christchurch shooter hung out, where he live-streamed it, it, just this absolute cesspool of racism and extremism and people urging each other onto greater acts of violence. Why is this still on the internet? Right? Okay, so he looked into it. He found it was because there's a guy, a white American guy in the Philippines who has his own server set up in the Philippines, so to get around the major internet companies. How does he fund this? He sells books about how to do sex tourism in the Philippines on Amazon. Right? He's lucrative enough to Amazon that Amazon sells his products. And that is how 8chan is funded.
Isn't global capitalism wonderful?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Many of you may have seen Jeff Bezos's images of, oh, this is what my space colony will look like. It's like, you've got some real problems to sort out down here first. Yep.
Well, we're going to have to think about doing a part two of this discussion because there's a lot more to talk about. But I just want you to join me in thanking all of our panelists and all the great guests.